we discussed Monday, we began to discuss the halachas of umdana, the circumstantial evidence, proof that falls short of actual eyewitness testimony of witnesses. We mentioned, generally speaking, that there are some places in Shas and Poskim that imply that there's a special halacha that for dinei nefashos, for capital cases, we have an especially high standard. Rambam brings Mechilta, V'naki v'tzadik al tarag, Mar and Sanhedrin, that for dinei nefashos is a particular rule that we require eyewitness testimony, but elsewhere for dinei mamonos, you could really rely on umdana. There are other places where the poskim seem to imply that mamonos and nefashos have the same standard, what works for one works for the other. Now the classic discussion of umdana, of circumstantial evidence in dinei mamonos, is the machlokas tanoim of gomel ocher ben agmalim. One camel is thrashing, another camel is found dead nearby. We assume he's the perpetrator, but we can't prove it. We paskin, that's not good enough. If it's not good enough for Mammon, it's certainly not good enough for Nefashos. The question is, though, how do we paskin Lamaise? Is Mammonus and Nefashos, is it the same standard? Or, again, is Nefashos more Chomer? And Lamaise, if, are there any umdanas that do work for Mammonus, that's what our Simon is all about, would they work for Nefashos too? So there is a remarkable position of Tosis. Doesn't always get the attention it deserves, apparently, but Tosfos seems to say pretty clearly that the Ikar LaHalacha is like the Gemara in Shavuos, not the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Shavuos seems to take for granted that Mamonos and Nefashos have the same standard, that whatever works for Mamonos would work for Nefashos. Even though we don't paskin like Rav Acha, even though we paskin that Gomel Ocher Bein Agmalim, that's circumstantial, that doesn't count, there are types of umdanas, Tosfos says, that would work both for Mamonos and for Nefashos. The example he brings is a Gemara. The Gemara is talking about Mamonos. The Gemara says, if two people are in a room, nobody else is in the room. One of them emerges with an injury, and the injury is a bite mark, so it couldn't have happened by him falling against the radiator or something. The bite is in such a place that it couldn't possibly be self-inflicted, like on his elbow or on his back or something. So it clearly was caused by a human. It was not caused by the guy himself. The only other person in the room was the alleged perpetrator, so it must be him. So that umdana we rely on to be motzi mamon. And Tosu says the equivalent thing in a capital case we would rely on to execute the murder.
The obvious question would be, I thought that the typical case is two guys run into the house, one guy's chasing him with a knife.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. So Tosu says that the example in murder would be if someone died of a bite to his skull, a bite through his cranium. There was nobody else in the room. It couldn't have been self-inflicted. We would execute the murder in such a case. That would be considered proof positive. Now, Eric is mentioning, we discussed on Monday, the classic case of an umdana that we don't rely on for nefashos, maybe not even for mamonos, is the case where somebody was chasing somebody into an abandoned building with a knife, chasing him with apparent murderous intent, and they come out, and one guy's dying, and the other guy's holding the bloody knife. We don't execute the murderer, and maybe that wouldn't even be enough for a civil case. The answer seems to be, the poskim seems to assume, that's not absolute proof. You didn't do a search of the room to make sure nobody was there. You're not actually sure what happened. The other things could have happened. It's not absolute, 100% compelling proof. It's strong circumstantial evidence, but in a case where, like this example of a bite on the back or something, which is considered absolutely absolute positive proof, then that would be enough even for nefashos. So basically, putting the poskim together, we have kind of three levels of umdana. We have certain umdanas, like gomel ha'ocher ben agmalim, that wouldn't work for even mamonos. We simply don't rely on that. That's just completely circumstantial. Rav Acha holds it's good enough, but we hold it's not good enough. Then there are umdanas that, like the Rambam, for example. The Rambam said, you don't rely on the umdana of Shimon ben Shetach because v'naki v'tzadik al tarag, that chronomer medayik, that some achronomer medayik, the Rambam would hold, you do rely on those umdanas for civil cases, for mamonos. So, for example, the Avnei Nezer and the Abinezer and Achiezer say that even though we pass in Gomel Ocher Ben Agmalim is not good enough, the umdana of Shimon Ben Shetach is good for Mamonos, albeit not for Nefashos, because that's a better umdana. That umdana is an umdana Gedola. They don't define what that means. They say it's an umdana Gedola. So in their case, they were dealing with other types of circumstantial evidence that a woman was unfaithful to her husband or something. So they say the question is, does that umdana rise to the level of Shimon Ben Shetach or the bloody knife, or is that more like the Gomel Ocher, which is completely worthless? And the third level of umdana is the bite on the back, which at least Tosfos holds would work even for nefashos. Not everyone agrees to all these three levels, but broadly speaking, we seem to have at least three basic levels. Now, there's another shita worth mentioning, shita of the Marik. The Marik brings other Gemaras that we rely on Umdanas to, let's say, interpret a contract, to understand what somebody meant when he took a certain action, when he did something, to read his mind. If it's ambiguous, what did he mean? The Gemara says we follow Umdana. For example, a fellow made a will. He gave away all his money to a non-family, and he thought he had no family, and then it turned out he had a long-lost son who was still alive, so we can reverse his will, because we say he never would have done it. And Umdana, he never would have done it had he known he had living children. Umdana, that we follow. So the Marik explains, if you don't know Bechlal, did he kill him, didn't he kill him, that we don't follow Umdana generally, except maybe in the really, 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 really airtight Umdana. Even then, maybe not. But at least in the, normally we say we don't follow Umdana. In a case where it's just details, it's interpreting what did he mean, interpreting an existing contract, that we do follow Umdana. He doesn't really explain why. What should the difference be? Rezal Melchemi Goldberg explains that he struggles with this. He tries to understand we don't have a clear rule for the poskim. Why are these two cases so conceptually so different? Rav Zalman Lechemia says, when you're trying to figure out the basic question of what happened to begin with, the Torah required Eidim because it's possible to get Eidim. You want to know, did he kill him, didn't he kill him? In general, it's possible somebody saw it. Maybe not. Many cases were done, you know, out of sight. But in principle, at least, it's realistic for there to be a requirement to bring Eidim. Questions that are fundamentally not susceptible, not amenable to witnesses, like what do they mean exactly, or he gives a number of other examples of details of a case. He brings a Gemara that if, even though normally we need Hasra, the Gemara says, at least according to some opinions, Hasra is necessary to determine Shogeg or Mezid. If someone is a Sone, if someone is known to hate the victim, and he killed him, we assume it was deliberate, not Shogeg. So why? We assume. It's an Umdana. Probably it was a Mezid. It's too much of a coincidence that his mortal enemy, mortal in, you know, in various senses, ended up killing him at B'Shogeg. It's stretching. It's an Umdana. It's not proof. It's possible it was an accident, but we do rely on Umdana. So Rav Zalman Lechemia explains it's the same thing. For the basic question of what happened, did you do it or not, you need Eidim, because since that's a gross factual question, it will at least sometimes or in general be possible to bring Eidim. Details, what was the intention, what did you mean when you wrote the contract, stuff like that. Other examples, the Rambam Paskins, if someone struck somebody and we're not sure if the stone was heavy enough or lethal enough, we make an Umdana. We ask doctors to give their estimation of, was this something which reasonably could have killed him? Oh, we also rely on Umdana. So for details, for secondary points, we rely on Umdana, but for the basic question, for the basic questions we do require Eidim. Rav Zalman Lechemia's letter occurs in the context of a discussion about reporting child abusers to the police. One of the key questions is always, you rarely have two kosher witnesses testifying to what the fellow may have done. Everything relies on either circumstantial evidence or witnesses who are not kosher. Rav Zalman Lechemia, you're strongly on board with reporting people, and the question he deals with is the level of proof you need. And he's discussing Umdana, and his basic point is, after the fact, to convict somebody of a crime, you would need actually aidus. Umdana wouldn't be enough to actually impose a criminal penalty against him. But before the fact, if you feel he's an ongoing danger, he argues that's inherently a question of Umdana, that we have to judge, even though it's based on facts, what he's done in the past, if we have to judge, is this person a threat? Rav Zalman Lechemia says that is something that we would rely on Umdana to report somebody to the authorities. He does say you should go to Rabbanim first, which is a very controversial prescription. A lot of people don't like that, but he does say that you should consult with Rabbanim first in order to determine whether, you know, what to do, whether it is appropriate in these cases to go to the authorities. Poskim discuss these.
Why do you need an umdana for that? You can go to the authorities anytime you want. Well, what kind of an umdana do you need to report something that's suspicious to you?
This may have serious consequences for the person you're reporting. He could be jailed. He could be.
I understand, but you can go to a. You can go to a Rav and say, I have suspicion.
Yeah, you can go to the Rav, yes, but the question is whether the Rav should allow you going to the secular authorities. So for that, he's saying the Rav can rely on Umdanas. If in the Rav's judgment the Umdanas are sufficient, even though there are no Eidim, then the Rav can authorize you to turn him over to report him to the authorities.
So you need a Rav to be able to tell you that Umdanas is sufficient.
Yeah, right. The Post can discuss these questions in various other contexts. For example, there's a major debate in Hilchos Kedushin. Ideally, we know the witnesses are supposed to watch the actual giving of the ring from the man to the woman. What if they didn't see the actual transfer? They saw T-5 seconds. They saw him holding the ring, getting ready to give her the kedushin under the instructions of the Rav. And they saw T+5 seconds. They saw her holding the ring and smiling and whatever she does after getting the ring. They didn't see the actual handing over the ring. So That's a major debate among the poskim. Some poskim say the fact that they're in the wedding hall, she's dressed in her kala gown, and he's in the, all ready for kedushin, and all the guests are here, the photographer, and they see everything up to, except for that second. That's umdana. We know what happened between me and the lamppost. Everyone knows what just happened. Other poskim say no. There's a requirement that you have actual eyewitness testimony. Nothing suffices short of actual eyewitness testimony. Video is an interesting question. What role video would play, or even audio recording in certain, or even audio in certain cases? Would that suffice to be considered yediyah, absolute yediyah? But certainly, we know today with the possibility of tampering, of editing, you'd have to study carefully what you actually have. But in theory, at least. So let's discuss a couple of other related questions, and maybe we'll get back to video at the end. One question discussed by several 20th century poskim are lie detector tests. You'll see this in the poskim as either polygraph, pei vav lamed yud gimel resh vav pei, or lie detector actually spelled out, lamed yud yud, dalet ayin test, etc. Sometimes the Hebrew version, mechonat haemet. It's interesting that apparently in Hebrew they call it, what? Right, in Hebrew they call it the truth detector. And the truth is, lie detectors work both ways. Sometimes they'll say the test results will be he seems to be telling the truth. Sometimes it'll be he seems to be lying. Sometimes it'll be inconclusive. So, in English we call it a lie detector. In Hebrew they call it mechonat ha'emet, apparently. So a number of 20th century poskim have discussed this question. Bonus points goes to Rav Yehoshua Baumel, a noted Polish and then American posek, grandfather of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. When he discusses the question in his Emek Yoshua, Emek Halacha, he discusses both lie detectors as well as truth serum, test resh vav tat vav tests samach yud resh vav mem, which make people tell the truth, he says. So he discusses, Rav Avadia has a tshuva about this, the Debreziner and Bar Moshe, Tzitz Eliezer. The poskim are actually somewhat split on what evidentiary value lie detector tests have. Rav Avadia and the Tzitz Eliezer are not interested. They say, it's true, maybe umdanus in some cases work, even that, we don't pass like Rav Acha, Gomel HaOcher is not enough, lie detectors are really, they're inconclusive, they're not reliable, you anyway have to trust the technicians, if there's anyway a question of Aedus of an Eid Echad here, and the test itself is not so reliable. Rav Avadia does add a caution there. He says, science, technology progresses all the time. In the event that the technology advances to a point at which it is significantly more reliable than it is today, we will have to revisit the issue. But in the current state of affairs, he says, technology has no effect. It has no, Rav Avadia's case and Sicilia's case also were both divorce cases. There were cases where a husband, the Rav Avadia's case was a husband accused the wife of unfaithfulness. She was with a certain man. She said it was just her boss, it was business, and he said, you're lying. So he said, okay, you claim you're telling the truth, to submit to a polygraph. The question is, should she do that? Does it have any halachic weight? Rav Avadia says, no, it does not, and therefore you shouldn't make her do it because it's just not reliable and it's even less than all the umdanas that the poskim don't accept. Tzitz Eliezer also, he insists the Torah requires edim, two edim, nothing else is good. Again, the Tzitz Eliezer's treatment is a bit of an overstatement because many poskim discuss many cases where we do rely on umdana. Throughout our siman, we have examples of relying on umdana. We have other poskim say it in other places, so just categorically say for Mamonos or for Ishus we insist on Edim is not really so simple. But nevertheless, the basic conclusion is not one that's so hard to hear that a lie detector test would not be reliable. In Mechalach and the Debreziner, though, Bar Moshe, both seem to say that a lie detector does have some probative value. They both suggest that if the lie detector indicated clearly that even two Edim, if Edim were lying, you would dismiss the Edim. They bring proof, and they refer to the idea of Din Maruma, that if Beis Din is convinced that Edom are lying, they are not supposed to follow the Edom, they're supposed to throw out the Edom, they're supposed to keep investigating, maybe be Darish V'choker, try to refute the Edom, but you can't act on Edom if you're convinced they're lying. They both seem to assume, again, I don't know what they were told about the effectiveness of lie detector tests. I mean, if Rabbi Baumel, who died in 1948, is writing about truth serum, which was pretty much, I think, science fiction back then, I don't think it was such a reliable technology back then. I don't know what he was told about the effectiveness of lie detector tests, but in any event, that's goof what Rav Avadia says. He says he thinks Rav Baumel is giving much too much weight to lie detector tests, but in any event, the Debreziner and Rav Baumel both felt that there would be value of an umdana, essentially, umdana de muchach, to actually force us to set aside the testimony of witnesses. And there are similar things, a similar discussion about DNA evidence. DNA evidence in a criminal case is it's difficult to figure out an easy case. In most cases in courts of DNA evidence, you find a hair that can be proven to have been the accused on the floor. You find under the fingernails, you find some skin that can be traced to the alleged perpetrator. Even if all that is true, even if DNA evidence is literally 100% reliable, all you can prove is that he was there, that maybe they had some kind of fight. You can't prove that he killed him. So it still wouldn't be that much different from the case of the knife, that even if you prove he was there and he was present and he could have done it, at the end of the day, it's usually not going to be possible to prove that he actually did it. So it's still going to be, even if the evidence is 100% solid, it's still going to be, to some extent, circumstantial, because you don't know he did it, even if he was there. Where it's a more interesting question, really, is Aguna, where Postkim have, especially in the wake of the World Trade Center bombings, Postkim discussed extensively the question of whether DNA evidence is considered enough to be matter in Aguna. There, the case is easier to construct. You find a body. The body is unrecognizable. It's been destroyed, but you have DNA and you can prove that this body is so and so. Is that good enough? So there is actually considerable debate on this point. Most Postkim accept that DNA is worth something, but some Postkim, like Rav Zalman Nechemi himself, were willing to accept that DNA is basically solid evidence in and of itself. Since the odds are about a zillion to one about it being a coincidence, even though it's based on statistics and it's based on the aggregate of a number of matching base pairs, and it's all done through math, statistics, and a combination of small matches. But nevertheless, practically speaking, it can be shown conclusively the odds are about a zillion to one if you do it right, if you have enough tissue, whatever it is, that it's as reliable as anything else. This sort of Zalman Lechemia on the one hand, and according to some reports of Eliashiv and Shlomo Zalman, said that of course you rely on DNA, there's nothing that's better than that. Other Poskim weren't so sure, other Poskim were inclined to give it some weight, but perhaps not absolute proof. Rav Ozner's based and takes a kind of in-between position. And there were some Poskim who weren't willing to give it absolute proof. Regarding something like video, again, it would be difficult to know, assuming the video was literally impossible to forge or to alter, and we knew exactly what it said, presumably it would be like the case of Neshicha al the back of the head. Lamaisa, in the real world, though, you'd have to see how reliable the video is. Topic for further discussion.